This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The moment of shock is just unforgettable.
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby, available now.
For almost 3 years, many Ukrainians have been waking up to this. The sound of missiles, explosions, drones. These are sounds that my close family in Ukraine live with pretty much every day. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has devastated cities and taken countless lives. But beyond the physical conflict, another battle has been raging for information and facts. While Ukrainian official sources have on a few occasions been criticized for making misleading statements, Russia's digital army has rained down disinformation in Ukrainian timelines in an effort to undermine the nation's resolve.
Have you seen this?
In my day job covering disinformation for BBC Verify, I've witnessed the extent of the challenge.
Views spreading pro-Russian disinformation about the war in Ukraine.
I'm going to show you. To fight back, Ukrainians and their allies have deployed fact-checking and OSINT techniques. Now, OSINT stands for Open Source Intelligence. It has become a sort of shorthand for the job of investigating publicly available information. A lot of it is about working out what we can say from the vast amount of content publicly posted online, especially on social media platforms like X, TikTok, and the messaging app Telegram.
Тому це необхідно постійно контролювати, постійно.
We need to constantly control, constantly monitor all of it. So we dedicate our whole life, all our time to basically war.
Alongside fact-checking, it's been crucial in building a clearer picture of what's happening on the battlefield for journalists, politicians, and ordinary users. But the work does take its toll.
I'll be honest, it seems to me that we all live on the edge of this burnout.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Olga Robinson, and in this episode of BBC Trending, we'll be looking at how open source investigators and fact-checkers covering Ukraine are coping with the toll of documenting the war, nearly 3 years after Russia's full-scale invasion. It's easy to forget that Russia's war in Ukraine didn't start with the full-scale invasion in February 2022.
It was the 2nd of March 2014 when Russian soldiers without identification marks entered Crimea, but everyone understood that they were Russian soldiers. And at the same time, a huge number of fakes about Ukraine appeared in the information space. And these fakes were very often spread by Russian media, which until then we considered our colleagues. And it was such a big shock for Ukrainians that they can spread such blatant nonsense, because these were blatant fakes.
Yeah, my name is Olga Yurkova. I am a co-founder of Stop Fake. It's an independent fact-checking organization in Ukraine.
One story in particular helped the Stop Fake team realize their work mattered.
Sometime in 2014, Russian troops captured the city of Slavyansk in the Donetsk region. And then, when the Ukrainian army liberated this city, the Russian TV channel filmed a news report based on the words of only one woman, in which it said that when the Ukrainian army entered Slavyansk, they gathered all the residents in the central square and they crucified a boy, a three-year-old boy. It was a completely fabricated case. So far, no other fake has surpassed this story.
10 years later, StopFake's work to study Kremlin propaganda and counter it using a variety of tools has been more important than ever. Partly because Moscow has been bombarding Ukrainians with some of the same tropes that Olga and her colleagues saw emerging in 2014.
We feel that we are making Ukrainians more media literate, more resistant to disinformation, which is important now.
Olga doesn't shy away from talking about burnout caused by the intensity of work during wartime.
I'll be honest, it seems to me that we all live on the edge of this burnout. It has already happened to someone. Well, but I constantly feel that I'm somewhere on the edge, but I don't cross this line.
Olga says the key to avoiding burnout lies in organizing a routine and finding little distractions every day.
I try every day, even if I sit at the computer all day. I still try to go out for a walk at least in the evening. This really helps to stop this endless stream of thoughts and somehow get out of this wheel of emotions. Also, some such things are pleasant, like, for example, a bath with fragrant foam. Well, when there is such an opportunity, that is. Some such delicious food, cooking. I like to cook shakshuka for breakfast. I disconnect from all this world around me, with its problems, with disinformation, with politics, with everything else. And at this moment, I somehow recover.
Professor Anthony Feinstein, a psychiatrist who was the first to research the effects of conflict reporting on journalists, says these kind of distractions are essential for recovery.
Respite is necessary to build your resilience. And, you know, respite can be, you know, taking your relaxing bath or scented candles, going for walks. You really want to come back all the time to building retirement relationships, which are moments of respite, getting good sleep is, you know, respite, but doing things other than fixating on the war. And if you can build in your moments of respite on a regular basis, on a daily basis if possible, you build your resilience. And this will leave you in a better position to cope with what you're doing.
Olga says she's also had to develop a thick skin to protect herself from online hate and abuse female journalists and fact-checkers are so often targeted with.
In Ukraine, by the way, a study was recently published about online abuse against women. That is, not only against fact-checkers, but in general. Against women journalists, against women activists, for example. It is very widespread. In fact, statistically, there are more such comments against women.
Online harassment and trolling is a relatively new challenge for those covering conflicts and something that reporters previously haven't had to deal with, says Professor Feinstein.
You're not just doing this physically difficult work and very dangerous work, but there's now the whole added complication of online social media and harassment and fake news and, you know, that whole ghastly mess that's out there to try and discredit what you're doing. And so, you know, you didn't have this in the Balkans. You didn't have it in Lebanon or in Vietnam the way you've got it now. And so you've got journalists doing this very difficult work, and you're also doing it against the backdrop of Russia's, you know, spending vast amounts of money to discredit you and the validity of things and truth online.
It's not only journalists facing these challenges, though. Roman Pahariely and Ruslan Mikula are probably Ukraine's most well-known OSINT duo. They're not journalists by trade, and neither has served in the army or has had military experience. Roman has previously worked as a lawyer, and Ruslan is a former marketing specialist. Together, they run the influential Deep State project that has over 800,000 followers on the Telegram messenger alone. The work is relentless, says Roman, who, on a video call, looks like any young Ukrainian you might meet in a Kyiv coffee shop.
The working day is 24/7, absolutely day and night. We wake up with Deep State.
At the heart of the project is an interactive map of the front line. It incorporates both verified footage and insight from soldiers and provides granular updates on the state of the war. While they openly say that they are cooperating with Ukraine's defense ministry, sometimes their analysis puts them at odds with official accounts from both Moscow and Kyiv. Deep State started in 2020 as a hobby to share updates on various global conflicts, and now it takes up pretty much all of their time.
We need to constantly control, constantly monitor all of it. So we dedicate our whole life, all our time to the Deep State and basically war.
I ask how they cope with such a relentless pace and if they ever feel signs of burnout.
First of all, we cannot say so, because there are people there who feel all of this much harder and are experiencing the moments of their lives at the front line, somewhere in the trenches. We have no right to say so.
Unlike Roman, Ruslan wears what looks like military fatigues.
We have moments, in fact very difficult, when we deal with executions. Well, we have a lot of acquaintances who have been killed, members of the team and those to whom we went. Sometimes, of course, we don't feel great.
Yet, working under such pressure and in the face of loss doesn't seem to affect Deep State's founders' resolve.
I want the most severe responsibility possible for the enemy, for the criminal. It is difficult, but we have no other choice but to do something.
They use the same approach to working with graphic and upsetting material, of which there's been plenty.
We just work. It sounds a little scary and somehow strange now, but it's, well, it's everyday life. You can't escape from it. but everyone distracts themselves as best they can.
For us, a trip to the East is like a vacation. That is, when most of the time we are not directly busy with work, we are on the road.
I'm quite shocked. Going to the front line in the east of Ukraine to recharge after working day in and day out on the war, that sounds pretty extreme. Roman hastily adds.
Well, it is important to note that it is not about going to war, sitting under shelling and getting a kick out of it. This is about going to people, communicating with them, recharging. That is, the people who are now in the worst conditions possible in this life, when they smile, rejoice, when they have a motivation to live. Well, I don't know if in such conditions they can be there with positivity, of course. This positivity is transmitted.
But even back home in Kyiv, there's no way to escape the war, especially if you're Ukrainian, says Professor Feinstein.
You know, when you're living in the midst of a war zone, you can't leave. There's no downtime, there's no respite. You know, Western journalists who fly into conflict zones like the Ukraine or the Middle East, they would go for 4 or 6 weeks and come home and have a period of, you know, relaxation and relative safety and then go back. But to the local journalists, you just don't have that. And so it's constant, constant stress.
I'm Olga Robinson, and you're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. Coming up, you'll hear the radically different ways others are coping with covering the war.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Olga Robinson, and this is the documentary with BBC Trending. And it's not just Ukrainians that have been following the developments closely.
Hello, I'm Andrew Perpetua. I make a map of Ukraine called Ukraine Daily Update. We focus on geolocating as much footage as we can in Ukraine, whether it be from Russian sources, Ukrainian sources, government or military or civilian. We try to track war crimes and military changes on the battlefield. And we also track stats for various forms of statistical analysis, including weapon usage, vehicle losses, casualties, and things like that.
Before the full-scale invasion, Andrew, who lives in New York, worked as a data analyst in baseball. But his interest in Ukraine goes back to 2014, when one of his friends was forced to flee eastern Ukraine after Russia's forces first invaded. Then in February 2022, he was in between jobs.
At first, I just wanted to bring the information to baseball people in general. Basically, I was doing the reading for them because a lot of people were very interested in what was going on, but they had no time to keep up with it and they don't know anything about Ukraine. Like, and it just evolved from there.
Since then, he's been doing it pretty much every day, alone at first, and now with a team of volunteers from around the world. Here's what a typical day is like, according to Andrew.
I wake up around 2 a.m., so this would be like 9 a.m. in Ukraine, I think. I read the overnight stuff. I read like reports from the governors, reports from just national news sources from Ukraine. Then once that's done, we all start gathering videos. So we have hundreds and hundreds of channels that we go through and we gather their content and we put them all into our database. And then I work until around 6 p.m. and then do it again the next day. I feel like it's like a Groundhog's Day thing. I do the same thing every day.
I mean, from what you described there in terms of what your day looks like, it sounds pretty relentless to me. And you've been doing it day in and day out, as you said yourself, a bit of a Groundhog Day. So how do you keep going?
I don't know. It's very tiring. I mean, there are days where you feel like it's impossible. Really, the thing that keeps you going is when you get tired and you miss a day. And then it takes like 10 times more work to catch up again than having just done it.
And that's why, Andrew tells me, he feels like he can't really afford a proper day off.
I mean, the closest that I've ever had to having off time was just doing less work than I should have. Yeah, since July of 2023, it's been like nonstop.
And on an average day, how many videos do you deal with now that you have to verify and geolocate?
And as a team, it's like, it's so crazy. Like, so for the past few days, we did 263, 242. Every video is like at least 5 minutes of work minimum. So when you're doing like 260 of them a day times 5 minutes, like it adds up. It really adds up. It's just so much work. So sometimes, like, I don't even understand how we do this much work, honestly.
How do you cope with that relentless amount?
I mean, we all kind of have bonded over it. We have like a lot of humor. We have a lot of dark humor.
You can get a glimpse of this dark humor in Andrew's YouTube updates.
Welcome to the theater, where the stage is mud and snow, where armies march in circles.
The music itself is AI generated, yes, but the author is Gik. He writes the songs, the vast majority of them. But other people, like I wrote like two.
But wrote this some is song as well.
Yeah, so this is another one of our coping mechanisms. is music. We have a giant folder of songs of every single topic, of war related anyway. We have economic songs. We have songs about various vehicles. We have songs about each member of our team has
no
different
way.
Songs. Yeah.
So that's amazing. Maintaining good relationships is extremely important to protect your mental health when dealing with distressing content, according to Professor Feinstein.
If you've got good relationships, that becomes the single biggest protective factor against mental health difficulties in journalists. And doesn't matter whether you're an Afghan or a Kenyan or a Mexican or an Israeli or a Syrian, if your relationships are strong, it's a very important buffer against mental health difficulties.
Despite the various coping mechanisms, Andrew says the long days have affected his health.
Mental health, you'd be surprised. Like, I feel like my mental health's fine, but physical health, like, for sure. Like, sitting, you're not supposed to sit in a chair working for 18 hours a day.
But it's not this stress or volume of work that he finds the hardest.
I've had friends who have died in combat, and I think that's probably the worst. Yeah. So, yeah, people that I talk to a lot, and also people who, I don't even know how to phrase this, but I guess I could say they survived combat and they didn't, I mean, they're alive physically, but like mentally, they're not anymore. And that's really heartbreaking.
Our interviewees clearly deal with the stress and the cost of war in Ukraine very differently, but they do seem to have one thing in common, determination to carry on. As Raman from Deep State puts it,
there are two choices. You can give up and just cry, or you can turn all this anger into work so that it turns into something, for example, revenge. That's why it's hard. But we have to. We have to do something.
That's it this week for this episode of the documentary from BBC Trending. I'm Olga Robinson. Thanks to producers Jana Lushnevska and Alex Murray and Hal Haynes for mixing this episode. Our editor was Flora Carmichael. If you want to message Trending with your thoughts on this or any of our other programs, then you can email me at olga.robinson@bbc.co.uk. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme. Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme. Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.